Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge is withered from the lake, and no birds sing. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, so haggard and so woe begone? The squirrel's granary is full, and the harvest done. I see a lily.
You're listening to the voice of Dame Edith Evans reading La Belle Dame Sans Merci by John Keats, a page from this afternoon's edition of Anthology. This is Fleetwood. Each Sunday at 1:30, WNBC, in conjunction with the Poetry Center of the YM and YWHA, 92nd Street and Lexington Avenue in Manhattan, brings you Anthology, a selection of readings from poets past and present, and the music to accompany their poetry. Our guests today, by transcription, Mel Allen, William Carlos Williams, Wallace House, and Dame Edith Evans. For the benefit of any new listeners who are joining us at our new time this Sunday, we thought it might be appropriate to orient you briefly on the nature of anthology, perhaps even produce some of the fabric from which we've fashioned this series during the past 30 weeks. May we say at the outset that anthology is a poetry program with distinctly Catholic tastes. At times we become very serious and listen to readings from the great classic poetry of England and France, or by contrast, the modern works of T.S. Eliot, Dylan Thomas. We've been visited on records by some of the famous stars of stage and screen, Sir Laurence Olivier, Charles Laughton, Judith Anderson, and we've extensively explored the poetry of our own native land, accompanied by Carl Sandburg, Robert Frost, and William Carlos Williams, whom we'll revisit just a little later in the program. Anthology also believes in keeping in tune with the times, and if current events call for a special poem, we're happy to make sure it's available. Like this.
Take me up to the ball game. Take me up with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care.
Yes, Wednesday at the Polo Grounds, the World Series between the New York Giants and the Cleveland Indians will get underway with a capacity crowd of baseball fans from coast to coast, cramming the boxes and bleachers via radio and television. Anthology couldn't possibly permit this important event to pass unnoticed, and so we've asked one of NBC's favorite sportscasters to read for you the great American baseball epic. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Mel Allen with Casey at the Bat.
It looked extremely rocky for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 2-4 with but an inning left to play. And so when Cooney died at second and Burroughs did the same, a pallor wreathed the features of the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go, leaving there the rest with that hope which springs eternal within the human breast. For they thought if only Casey could get a whack at that, they'd put even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, and likewise so did Blake. And the former was a puddin', and the latter was a fake. So on that stricken multitude, a death-like silence sat. For there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and the much-despised Blakey tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and they saw what had occurred, There was Blakey safe at second and Flynn a-hugging third. And then from the gladdened multitude went up a joyous yell. It rumbled in the mountaintops. It rattled in the dell. It struck upon the hillside and rebounded on the flat. For Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. Ah, there was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat. No stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. And then when the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance glanced in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. That ain't my style, said Casey. Strike one, the umpire said. From the benches, black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on the stern and distant shore. Kill him! Kill the umpire! Shouted someone on the stand. And it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He made the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew. But Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, strike two. Fraud, cried the maddened thousands, and the echo answered, fraud. But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain, and they knew that Casey would not let the ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lips. His teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel vengeance his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go, and now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. Ah, but there's no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out.
Thanks, Mel. A very stirring rendition of Casey at the Bat. And we'll be listening this coming Wednesday when it's Play Ball for the World Series 1954. While we're discussing the lighter side of the poetic picture, we might mention for the benefit of our new friends that in the past, we've had a lot of fun listening to the humorous verse of such poets as Ogden Nash and Dorothy Parker. David Ross paid us a visit one Sunday and brightened our day with his interpretation of Lewis Carroll's The Jabberwocky, read to the music of Tony Mottola. We have a lot more comedy verse planned for the weeks ahead, poems to please not just the young, but the young at heart as well. For example, scheduled for early in October are a series of English dialect poems read by a gentleman with a tremendous mustache and a gay twinkle in his eye named Wallace House. One poem which particularly delighted us deals with a young lady named Little Aggie. You see, Little Aggie has a problem because of her size. But suppose we listen to Wallace House because he knows the story much better than I do.
When Joe Dove took his elephants out on the road, he made each one hold fast with his trunk to the tail of the elephant walking in front to stop them from doing a bunk. There were 15 in all, so 'twere rather a job to get them linked up in a row. But once he had fixed them, Joe knew they'd hold on, for an elephant never lets go. The pace it was set by the biggins in front. 'Twas surprising how fast they could stride. And poor little Aggie, the one at the back, had to run till she very near died. They were walking one Sunday from Blackpool to Crewe. They'd started at break of the day. Joe followed behind with a bag full of buns in case they got hungry on way. They travelled along at a rattling good pace over moorland and valley and plain. And poor little Aggie, the one at the back, her trunk fairly creaked with the strain. They came to a place where the railroad crossed. An ungated crossing it were. and they wasn't to know, as the express was due at the moment that they landed there. They were halfway across when Joe saw the express. It came tearing along up the track. He tried hard to stop, but it wasn't much good, for an elephant never turns back. He saw if he didn't do something at once, the train looked like spoiling his troop. So he ran on ahead and waggled his buns to show them they'd best hurry up. When they caught sight of the buns, they all started to run, and they soon got across at this gate, excepting poor little Aggie, the one at the back. She was just 1 second too late. The express came dashing along at full speed and caught her end on, fair and square. She bounced off the buffers, turned head over heels, and lay with her legs in the air. Joe thought she were dead when he saw how she lay with the back of her head on the line. He knelt by her side, put his ear to her chest, and told her to say 99. She waggled her tail and she twiggled her trunk to show him that she were alive. She hadn't the strength for to say 99. She just managed a weak 85. When driver of engines got down from his cab, Joe said, "Here's a nice howdy-do to see 15 elephants ruined for life by a clumsy great driver like you." Said the driver, "There's no need to make all this fuss. There's only one it as I've seen." Joe says, "Aye, that's right. But they held on so tight, you've pulled back end off to the 14. Joe still walks around with his elephant troop. He got them patched up at the vet's. But Aggie won't walk at the back anymore, 'cause an elephant never forgets.
Poetry, like all the arts, is always a ripe target for criticism, pro and con. Anthology, naturally, is no exception to the rule. We've been highly touted by the trade papers, such as Variety. We were very complimented to read our name in Time magazine a few weeks ago. But we can and do make mistakes. And then our letterbox overflows with venomous notes of all shapes and sizes. As a matter of fact, right now we're digging our way out from under the deluge caused by a recording we played last week of two odes of John Keats, read by Vincent Price, with original music composed and played by George Antheil. I don't believe a single letter we received suggested that the recording company allowed the background music to become too loud. Our WNBC engineers, instead, were accused of A, having tin ears, or B, hating Keats or Vincent Price or both, and consequently drowning them in piano music. We like our engineers. We're rushing to their defense. They had nothing to do with the music on the Vincent Price record. It was mixed by the company which markets the album. We thought it was a little loud, too, when we auditioned the records before using them on the air. But we assumed they were meant to be that way. Modern music with great classic poetry. Something experimental, perhaps. For all of you who prefer your Keats sans music, we have a dividend this week. Also a preview of a program you'll be hearing on Anthology 2 weeks from this Sunday, when we bring you Dame Edith Evans with a series of poems ranging from the romantic sonnets of William Shakespeare to this unhappy but beautifully archaic ode by John Keats, La Belle Dame sans Merci.
Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge is withered from the lake, and no birds sing. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, so haggard and so woe-begone? The squirrel's granary is full, and the harvest's done. I see a lily on thy brow, with anguish moist and fever dew, and on thy cheek a fading rose, fast withereth too. I met a lady in the meads, full beautiful, a fairy's child. Her hair was long, her foot was light, and her eyes were wild. I made a garland for her head, and bracelets too, and fragrant zones. She looked at me as she did love, and made sweet moan. I set her on my pacing steed, and nothing else saw all day long, for sidelong would she bend and sing a fairy song. She found me roots of relish sweet, and honey wild and manna dew. And sure in language strange, she said, I love thee true. She took me to her elfin grot, and there she wept and sighed full sore. And there I shut her wild, wild eyes with kisses for. And there she lullied me asleep, and there I dreamed. Ah, woe betide, the latest dream I ever dreamed on the cold hillside. I saw pale kings and princes too, pale warriors, death pale were they all. They cried, La belle dame sans merci hath thee in thrall. I saw their starved lips in the gloam, with horrid warning gaped wide, and I awoke and found me here on the cold hillside. And this is why I sojourn here, alone and palely loitering. Though the sedge is withered from the lake, and no birds sing.
Dame Edith Evans reading La Belle Dame Sans Merci by John Keats. This music was written by the American composer and singer of folk songs, Tom Scott. Tom was a guest on Anthology not too long ago and brought us three of the musical settings he is currently writing for Robert Stevenson's A Child's Garden of Verses. We hope when the project is completed, he'll pay us a return visit so we may hear his work in its entirety. As often as we possibly can, we try to bring to our Anthology microphone the men and women who are writing the poetry of our generation. One of the most entertaining and most honored of our guests was a doctor from Rutherford, New Jersey, who on September 12th celebrated his 77th birthday. I'm speaking, of course, of William Carlos Williams. Just prior to the publication of his latest book, The Desert Music and Other Poems by Random House, Dr. Williams came to call. And here are some of the highlights from that banner day in Anthology's history. I began our interview with Dr. Williams by saying, Dr. Williams, we're very happy that you took the trouble to journey in from Rutherford to visit us this afternoon. Welcome to Anthology.
Thank you.
You know, we've been wanting to meet you for quite some time, and luckily for us, your new book has just come out, which gave us a good excuse. But I'd like to ask you something before we get into talking about your book and perhaps asking you to read some of the poetry. There was an article in the New York Times, 2 weeks ago, maybe? I'm sure you read it, in which Lord Dunsany was quoted as saying that the role of the poet should be that of a prophet, that the poet should give us guideposts to the future. And he feels that today's poets are failing us and that this is all the worse because we are living in such a chaotic age. And he feels that the poet should be bringing us out of this chaos, but instead, what is he doing? He is just bringing more chaos upon chaos.
Well, it's obvious that Lord Dunsany doesn't understand what he's reading. It's the writing nowadays is very much more complex than when he was an active poet. And the ideas are more complex, too, and the world is more complex. But it's... Besides, for myself, he's an Englishman
mm-hmm.
who does not speak the same language that I do at all. And I can't ask him to adapt himself to the language which I speak. Nevertheless, it is very, very obvious to me that writers in the past, who were supposed to be intelligible, when they were most didactic, they were least poets.
Mm-hmm.
Poems have always been difficult to understand because they're imaginative And they speak a language, not the language of every day, but a symbolic language that is many times means exactly the opposite from what is stated. It is clear. It is clear if you get used to the language, but it is more for the pleasure, the sensory pleasure of reading the language which poems first come to us.
Well, your new book, Dr. Williams, which just came out on Thursday, The Desert Music and Other Poems, this is what? How many other books have you had prior to this?
Well, I've never counted them, but the list inside the cover says that there are more than 20 books. Not all poems, not all books of poetry, mm-hmm. but at least 20 books. That's not too much for 45 years of writing.
Well, I think it's quite a record when you consider, too, that those 45 years have been filled with practicing medicine.
Yes, and filled, too.
Well, Dr. Williams, I'd like, if you would be so kind, as to read some of your poems for us this afternoon from this new selection.
I'll be very glad to attempt to.
Well, I'm just going to turn the microphone over to you now, and you just read on, will you?
Well, thank you.
We'll listen.
All right. I'll do the best I can. I'm at the present time not in a position to read easily. The first of them is the first one in the collection. The Descent. The descent beckons as the ascent beckoned. Memory is a kind of accomplishment, a sort of renewal, even an initiation, since the space that opens are new places inhabited by hordes of new, heretofore unrealized, of new kinds, since their movements are toward new objectives, even though formerly they were abandoned. No defeat is made up entirely a defeat, since the world it opens is always a new place, formerly unsuspected. A world lost, a world unsuspected, beckons to new places, and no whiteness lost is so white as the memory of whiteness. With evening, love wakens, though its shadows, which are alive by reason of the sun shining, grow sleepy now and drop away from desire. Love without shadows begins to awaken as night advances. The descent, made up of despairs and without accomplishment, realizes a new awakening, which is a reversal of despair. For what we cannot accomplish, what is denied to love, what we have lost in the anticipation, a descent follows, endless and indestructible. The second poem is The Host. According to their needs, this tall Negro evangelist at a table separate from the rest of his party, these two young Irish nuns, to be described subsequently, and this white-haired Anglican have come witlessly to partake of the host laid for them and for me by the tired waitresses. It is all, since eat we must, made sacred by our common need. The evangelist's assistants are most open in their praise, though covered, as would be seemly in such a public place. The nuns are all black, a side view. The cleric, his head bound to reveal his unruly pall, dines alone. My eyes are restless. The evangelist eat well, fried oysters and whatnot, at this railway restaurant. The sisters are soon satisfied, one on leaving, looking straight before her under steadfast brows, reveals blue eyes. I myself have brown eyes and a milder mouth. There is nothing to eat. Seek it where you will, but the body of the Lord. The blessed plants and the sea yielded to the imagination intact, and by that force it becomes real. Bitterly to the poor animals who suffer and die that we may live. The well-fed evangels, the narrow-lipped and bright-eyed nuns, the tall white-haired Anglican, proclaim it by their appetites, as do I also, chomping with my worn-out teeth. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. No matter how well they are fed, how daintily they put the food to their lips, it is all according to the imagination. Only the imagination is real. They have proclaimed it. They have imagined it. Therefore, it is so. Of the well-fed, of the evangels with the long legs characteristic of the race, the docile women of the party smiled at me when, with my eyes, I accosted them. The nuns, but after all, I saw only a face, a young face cut off at the brows. It is a simple story. The cleric, plainly from a good school, interested me more. A man with whom I might carry on a conversation. No one was there save only for the food, which I alone, being a poet, could have given them. But I had only my eyes with which to speak.
Thank you, Dr. Williams. We hope that during the past 30 minutes, any of you who might have joined us for the first time in our new time will have gathered some idea of the premise behind this Sunday series. Any suggestions you have to offer will be most appreciated, and perhaps we can look forward to your company, along with the company of our old anthology friends, all during the fall and winter seasons ahead. And so, Anthology number 30, dated Sunday, September 26th, and the new time, 1:30 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Next week, Poetry Americana. Archibald MacLeish reading many of his best-known poems and Howard Hanson's songs from drum taps, based on the poems of Walt Whitman, with the composer conducting the Eastman Rochester Symphony Orchestra and the Eastman School of Music Chorus. Anthology is brought to you by WNBC in conjunction with the Poetry Center of the YM and YWHA, 92nd Street and Lexington Avenue in Manhattan, John Malcolm Brennan, director. The program is produced by Steve White, written and directed for WNBC by Draper Lewis. Until next Sunday at 1:30, this is Fleetwood wishing you good afternoon and good reading.